You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, we start in a spot that looks like it could be almost anywhere in California. A parking lot overlooking a freeway attached to a Starbucks drive-thru and a no-frills motel. Of course, you're not just anywhere. This particular spot happens to be in Compton, and the motel isn't really a motel anymore. You can't just stop and check in. Instead, it's serving as temporary housing for people experiencing homelessness. This building, the Willow Tree Inn, is part of HomeKey, an ambitious statewide program designed to bring thousands of unhoused people indoors quickly. Since last year, Governor Gavin Newsom has sent nearly $850 million to cities and counties to buy empty motels like this one and convert them into homeless housing. In Los Angeles so far, there are 37 HomeKey sites, according to the most recent numbers put out by the county, with more on the way. For now, these properties are filling a critical gap for the unhoused. They're providing more stability than a traditional shelter, but most are not permanent places to stay. So what is it like to live in that kind of limbo? KCRW reporter Anna Scott and Saul Gonzalez from KQED's The California Report teamed up to find out. And now they bring you this close-up on one resident at the Willow Tree Inn.
Hey, Saul here. And going in, we wondered, how do you build stability in a place that's not permanent?
Yeah, especially one designed for people passing through, like this motel.
And when you walk into the Willow Tree, it still looks a lot like a motel, with a check-in desk and everything.
Through the lobby and up the stairs, the rooms are arranged around a courtyard.
Hi. Hi, Omar.
Here, we meet up with Omar Molina. He's 55 years old, and he moved into this room in May.
It's like an all-in-one. I have my bed here, I have a microwave, I have a flat screen TV with cable.
And Omar's proud of his place, though he doesn't like the dark gray color of one wall near his bed.
Although I wish I could paint the walls, one of the walls, but it's okay, I'm grateful.
He can't paint the walls because he's only staying here temporarily. Like most HomeKey sites in LA, this motel isn't serving as permanent housing, at least not yet. That's because it doesn't meet all the codes and requirements for long-term housing. For example, it needs to be made more accessible to people with disabilities.
So the county opened the building as temporary housing for now, until those renovations can be done. But still, Omar says he feels a lot more stable here than he did in a shelter he stayed at in the past.
There's always distractions here. It's quieter. I'm more at peace. I can relax. I can take a deep breath and I can exhale. And I can say, oof, that was trying or something like that. And it still has we have security here and keeps me safe.
This motel has a cocoon-like feel to it. There's medical offices on-site, case managers, group counseling sessions, and even social activities like exercise classes, manicure days, and karaoke nights. I asked Omar if he participates in that stuff.
Yeah, actually, I did with the game nights. Yeah, because I'm, a happy-go-lucky fella. I won a shirt and I won some shampoo. We play bingo on Saturday nights.
Immediately before coming here, Omar stayed in a tent on a parking lot in the San Fernando Valley.
It was scary. I felt lost. I felt confused. Embarrassed. And there was embarrassment. And there were fears, a lot of fears.
He says he's struggled with medical problems since an accident he had as a kid. And over the years, he's also dealt with mental health issues and substance abuse, though he's sober now. He was married once, but that fell apart. And he struggled financially, too.
In other words, Omar's story is pretty complicated, and many residents at this motel and other HomeKey locations have stories like this, and they need a lot of services, like counseling. So it's a big win to have many of those services on site. That's according to John Masseri, the head of the nonprofit The People Concern, which operates this motel plus two other HomeKey properties.
Most of the referrals have actually been people who have been on the streets. They're coming right from the streets.
You know how Omar said how he feels more at peace here than in a group shelter? Well, John Masseri says private rooms are also a huge part of getting people into HomeKey.
People are much more likely to want to come indoors if they have a a space where they can, you know, close the door. They have their own bathroom. They have their own sleeping area. You know, people who lived on the streets want the same thing that all of us want. And they want privacy. They want dignity. They want some sense of control over their life.
But this home key site isn't a home yet.
Yeah, first, the building needs a $14 million renovation. The county will pay for that work using federal dollars. They plan to start in April of next year and be done within 10 months. If residents like Omar are still here when renovations begin, the people concerned will find them other temporary places to stay.
In the meantime, though, Omar is searching for a permanent apartment elsewhere. Recently, he turned one down in Van Nuys. He felt that the location was just too isolated. He says he sees where he is now in Home Key as a huge opportunity that he's grateful for. He doesn't want to blow it by moving on too soon or going someplace that's not a healthy fit for him.
Well, for me, being here, it means a place of starting over, getting another chance, getting to fix myself, if you will, or heal myself. You know, it's given me a place to regroup, to rebuild my foundation, and to just basically help myself be able to help somebody else eventually. That's my goal.
Recently, the state started taking applications for a second round of Home Key funding, and LA City and County are expected to buy more properties to turn into housing.
That's KCRW's Anna Scott along with Saul Gonzalez from KQED's The California Report. And this is Greater LA on KCRW. Coming up next, Battle Royale at the Ravine tonight and a rivalry that is unrivaled in most baseball circles. And later, it's not just the birds and the beaches of OC covered in oil. Some local politicians are getting slathered by that spill as well. You're listening to Greater LA and we're back on the other side of this.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Seventh inning stretch here on Greater LA from KCRW. Steve Chiatakis here. The National League Division Series comes to Chavez Ravine tonight for Game 3 between the Dodgers and the San Francisco Giants. Friday night was a shutout disaster for the Blue Crew in the Bay. Then, Saturday night, the bats were cracking.
Will Smith leads off.
And the first pitch to Will Smith is hammered to left, back to the wall, and it is gone, a home run. Will Smith, who hit 25 home runs during the regular year, on the very first pitch he sees from Zach Littell, and the Dodgers take a 7-2 lead.
The Dodgers won that game 9-2 Saturday night. Now the teams are tied at one game apiece. Winner of the best of five moves on to the league championship series against the winner of the Braves or the Brewers. The Dodgers, of course, are looking to repeat their fortunes from last year when they won the whole kit and caboodle. Petros Papadakis co-hosts the Petros and Money Show on AM 570 LA Sports and my favorite Greek on LA radio, Yasu Petros.
You should like yourself more. Yasudas.
No, I don't. And Matthew Moreno is managing editor of the website Dodger Blue. Matthew, welcome back to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
I'm going to start with you, Matthew. Last time pitcher Max Scherzer started on the mound was that super stressful one-game sudden-death wild card matchup with the Cardinals that took a walk-off for the Dodgers to win. He gave up a home run early in that game. Is he rested and ready?
I think so. And I think, you know, more importantly, is it seems like he has solved some of the issues that were plaguing him in terms of mechanics. And you know, his first nine starts with the Dodgers, he was nearly unhittable. The last three, not quite as sharp. And of course, there was some regression to be expected. But as you said, his outing against the Cardinals, definitely he had a grind through that. He said Sunday night that he worked on his mechanics. It was a lower body issue. And he's full go and, you know, excited to face the Giants now.
Petros, the crowd very much played a role in the Dodgers' loss to the Giants at Oracle Park. On Friday night, they got smacked 4-0. They couldn't do anything, but then they came back the next night, and they smacked right back with a bunch of hits, and as you heard, you know, some good fortune. Will Smith had a homer, a lot of hits. How much of a factor will a packed house up at the Ravine make, do you think, in tonight's game?
Well, I mean, historically, everybody always feels better playing at home, but in baseball, it doesn't always tell the tale because you're talking about professionals, right? They're expected to be able to push through being booed or being yelled at. The real deflator, the old deflator mouse, is when you do something wrong,
right,
and everybody's cheers, and it makes you feel like you're literally the size of an ant. And, you know, when you're 30 years old and you have kind of a gnarled beard and you're a veteran baseball player, or you're Buster Posey type, you've been through that. You've almost come to a point, I think, a lot of these guys, where they embrace that and enjoy it. So I'm not as sure how much it means being at home, because there's always Giants fans in L.A. and there's always L.A. fans up in San Francisco ready to cheer regardless. But there's no doubt that the most electric playoff scene maybe in the world is Dodger baseball right now. It's the most visited sport year in and year out in the world because of the fan base here and the size of the stadium and the size of our city. So it is something to be proud of, and I know people are excited, but what kind of bearing does it have on these games with these pros? I don't know. Not as much as I think people put into it.
Surely the Dodgers won the attendance game this year too, at more than, what, 2 million, I think, over the course of the season. This rivalry, Petros, has a history of being, you know, cold and bitter. There is no love lost between the fans, and I think the fact that the Giants eked out a win in the National League West, right? They won by one game in the National League West over the Dodgers. Both teams have solid records this year. But we know that bad things can happen too, right? I mean, it can get really ugly.
Yeah. But you know, at the same time, all the mean nature toward the fans, it also enhances us. I mean, there'd be no Dodgers without the Giants, and vice versa. It's a relationship that we need. We need the rivalry. We love the fact that these two teams are playing in the playoffs. We love the fact that this is the first time it's ever happened, you know, because of the structure of the world of baseball. And we love that it's tightly contested. Now, did Dodger fans love to have the unpredictable Giants, who no one saw coming, take the division and boat race them all year? That was, I think, a big exercise in frustration, but it was exercised with the win in the wild card game.
Matthew, are you worried some fans may get a little crazy?
I mean, I think a little bit, only because we've seen it in the past with this rivalry and other rivalries, but I don't think that will come. I mean, for better or worse, I don't think it'll come until one of the teams is eliminated and the series is decided. I was up in San Francisco for games 1 and 2, and that press box is pretty much, you know, on the concourse with the fans, and there wasn't too much hostility. It was a lot, there was, of course, some banter back and forth, but it was a lot of, you know, Dodgers won game 2, so they were heckling Giants fans who were leaving early, telling them that they weren't going to be back at Oracle Park again this year. So it was all good-natured stuff.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's more than just a best in the West rivalry, right? This is like a rivalry between L.A. and San Francisco. And you know, there's the old saying, you know, San Francisco really hates L.A., and L.A. is like, who? You know, it's like wait, what? You know, we're just going on about our business. I mean, what do you, Petros, do you think that this is about L.A. and San Francisco more so than even the Dodgers and Giants?
I think it's bigger than even that. I mean, if you know, the history of baseball, as you know, these teams came from the East Coast. They were both in New York City. They came out basically together to California, confounding a whole universe of fans in the East. And they were pioneers in that way. So, I mean, this rivalry is a huge part of expanding the sport to become what we called America's pastime for so long. And it's really special. And it's great to see them facing off in the playoffs. Is it bigger? Is it regional? Absolutely, it's regional. I mean, we used to call them bats, you know, when I was a kid. Bay Area Tools.
You're feeding the monster, you know, Petros.
Well, for us, it was all, and you know, they make fun of us and say everybody shows up late and leaves early, and you know, and no one cares about the game or no one understands the sport here. You know, they have their quips too. The real ignored stepbrother is the San Diego Padre. They're the ones that are kind of like, hey, look at me, I'm down here doing something. And they had a disastrous year after high expectation.
Matthew, what's the read you're getting on injured favorites? You know, first baseman Max Muncy, pitcher Clayton Kershaw. Kershaw's not going to play, right?
Correct. Kershaw, he's done for the year. He told us before game one that he received a PRP injection to treat what he and the team is continuing to say is just a flexor tendon issue and not the UCL. And so his expectation remains that he's not going to need Tommy John surgery, but he definitely is out for the rest of October. I know you're going to kind of get to Max Muncy next. They keep saying it's sort of wait and see. Obviously, the Dodgers need to advance past this round. It's my belief that they would also have to reach the World Series before Muncy is able to come back. I don't see it in the NLCS. I think even the World Series is a little bit of a long shot just from hearing, you know, his elbow was dislocated on that play.
Ugly collision at first base.
Max himself and Dave Roberts have both said that there is other damage in there, but they haven't said what it is. Dave Roberts did rule out, like with Kershaw, it not being UCL. And so that is what has them optimistic. But there does seem to be, you know, along with the dislocation, there was some damage to the elbow. It's just unclear publicly what that was.
Take off the blue-tinted sunglasses, Matthew. Tell me, any prediction? What do you think?
I think Scherzer solves some of the issues that we saw in his past few starts and gets back to, you know, the dominant, probably Cy Young Award winning form that he had his first nine starts. And I think if the Dodgers win tonight, they take the series in four. However, if they lose tonight, I think they'd be in danger of losing the series in game five.
Ooh. Petros?
You're asking me for a prediction?
I want one. Come on.
All right. I'm going to
tell
you.
Come on, Trojan.
I think at
some
point,
give me one, Trojan.
Dave Roberts is going to get maligned on Twitter, even if it works out in the end. I can promise you that's going to happen. That's a number one.
Well, everybody gets maligned on Twitter, though. That's nothing new.
Yeah, but Dave, like, he'll be trending, you know, before the before we even know if the decision is going to work out or not.
That's right.
So that's one bold prediction. But I think Matthew's right. I think we're going to see two fired up pitchers, two guys that are going to really tear into the lineups. And it's going to be a knockdown, drag out, pins and needles type of nail biter, a la the wild card game the other night.
Petros Papadakis with AM570 LA Sports. Adio, Petros.
All right. Kalinikta.
Kalinikta, good night. Matthew Moreno, managing editor of the website Dodger Blue. Matthew, thank you for joining us.
Of course, anytime.
It's Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiotakis here. The OC oil spill has oozed into the politics of Orange County. The county, at least lately, is a politically mixed bag, and environmental issues like climate change have historically polarized the region. So what shape is the oil spill taking in local politics? LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano is here with KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So let's quickly check in on the spill itself. It's been a little more than a week since it happened, or at least since it was discovered. It could have been going on a long time. We talked about it last week with you and Professor Sean Anderson. What are things looking like now? How's the cleanup going over there?
It's cleaning up. People are cleaning up. The Coast Guard says the spill doesn't seem to be as catastrophic as originally planned, as originally forecasted. So instead of 144,000 gallons of crude oil spilled, now they say it could be as little as 50,000 or as much as 130,000. So it's okay. It's not going to be as horrific as possible. That said, they're finding oil down in San Diego. The cleanup is going on. We still haven't seen any mammals being affected just yet. But also Huntington Beach, the city of Huntington Beach, they opened up the affected beach just today. Newport Harbor, I know, has recently opened. So obviously the officials, they know there's a cleanup ahead of them, but they do not want their economies to be more affected than they already have been.
Now, some animals were affected, though. I mean, we talked about that last week.
Oh, yeah.
There weren't as many as planned. I mean, I know the wildlife folks were expecting a lot of animals coming in. Not so, which is good news. I want to talk a little bit, Gustavo, about climate change and environmentalism as an issue in Orange County politics. Remember, this is where Ronald Reagan said all good Republicans go to die, right? Has it played a big part these days? Is there the same divide along party lines as you see perhaps nationally?
It's really bizarre because, you know, all of this is affecting the coast, which is one of the last bastions of Republicanism in Orange County. But at the same time, you have Republicans, conservatives who aren't environmentalists because they want their coast to be completely pristine, completely clear. But then at the same time, you live there and you have these rising tides. And so there's been, the debate has been going on for years of how environmentalists do Huntington Beach and Newport and Dana Point and San Clemente want to get. This oil spill is very much a wake-up call for everyone involved that, okay, we all live in this wonderful coast that is just an economic engine for these cities in particular, and Orange County in general. We can't have something like this happen again. So do we want to be against oil? And of course, the Republican Party historically have been very cozy with oil and oil energy industry. So some of the politicians are saying, well, what do we do now?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned economic engine. I mean, I suspect there are a lot of Republicans who don't want the oil on the beach. They want the oil in their engines and their car engines, right? I mean, they want clean beaches, too.
Yeah, they want oil. I mean, that's the thing. They want oil. And so what you're seeing now, because it is such a partisan divide in Orange County, which it historically hasn't been, the Democrats are planning on 2022 for very much hearkening to this oil spill. And it's, you know, let's not forget that the oil platforms are in federal waters, which there can still be oil exploration out there. But now you're going to see California's both state assembly members, state senators, and the congressional members definitely pushing for an outright ban on any oil exploration. So you're going to have Congresswomen or congresspeople like Katie Porter from Irvine, Mike Levin down in San Clemente, who used to be an environmental lawyer, by the way, definitely pushing for that. On the other hand, you have Michelle Steele, the congresswoman who represents Huntington Beach and Newport Beach. And she, of course, is saying, well, we do got to clean it up and what a tragedy. But now she's accusing Democrats of politicizing the issue because they've pointed out that she has accepted campaign contributions from oil companies.
She has refused to say if she supports an end to offshore drilling. Could the spill represent a danger for her in the 2022 election?
It depends on how quickly they clean up in Huntington Beach and also her statements, frankly, on it. If she does appear to be tone deaf to the economic concerns of the people there in Huntington Beach. I mean, look, they elected her narrowly, yes, but they elected her in 2020. But if she seems tone deaf and not caring for, you know, these dead birds, not caring for these shuttered businesses and seeming too beholden to oil companies, then yeah, it's definitely going to hurt her. And it remains to be seen who's going to be the opponent against her from the Democrats in 2022. I wouldn't be surprised if it was Harley Ruda, who did serve one term as a congressman after defeating the longtime incumbent Dana Rohrabacher and in 2018. But you know, with whatever vulnerability she might have when it comes to this issue, he or the Democratic Party, both of them are going to take it and then some.
Yeah. Before we let you go, let's talk about the great tortilla tournament, shall we? The tournament. Gustavo, quickly, we have less than a minute. Who won and why is this important?
Burrito La Palma won the Golden Tortilla. They beat Taco Maria in Taco Maria does corn, Burrito La Palma does flour from El Monte, Santana. It's important because the tortilla tournament celebrates tortilla culture in Southern California. Eat great tortillas, eat better tortillas, eat Burritos La Palma. Go to kcrw.com/tortilla for all tortilla, all the masa madness.
Corn or flour? Quickly.
It depends on the day, but flour won this year.
Flour won, but where are you? Where are you on the...
That's what I said. It depends on the day. Like, if I want a quesadilla, I'm going flour. If I need a good tortilla, corn.
All right. I'm with you on that. Gustavo Arellano. Congratulations, by the way, on a very successful tour tournament this year. Columnist for the LA Times. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias.
And congratulations, by the way, to everybody who participated in that. That's going to do it for us this evening. Tomorrow, a most unusual Angelino. He wrote a number one hit and a lot of other music for big name artists, but he lived most of his life outside, under the Hollywood sign, or in a friend's backyard, or out in the desert. A fascinating life with music on tomorrow's episode of GLA. All the shows, by the way, at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Subscribe to the podcast. Get it fresh to your feed when we drop new episodes. Tell us how you're doing. Tell us how we're doing at kcrw.com/GLA. Catherine Barnes, Jackie Sedley, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all help piece the show together. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thank you for your ears and for your time tonight. Have a great night.